Penguin Random House Audio presents Ascent to Power, How Truman Emerged from Roosevelt's Shadow and Remade the World, by David L. Roll. Read for you by Mark Bramhall. In memory of my parents, two such as you cannot be parted nor be swept away. Robert Frost. Prologue. Death and Rebirth. On the morning of July 9, 1944, a muggy Sunday in wartime Washington, the Hudson Valley patrician and so-called common man from Missouri were getting ready for their respective road trips. Outside the White House, a four-man Secret Service detail was waiting for President Franklin Roosevelt to be wheeled out and assisted into the back seat of an armored Lincoln limousine. In his apartment at the corner of Connecticut Avenue and Chesapeake Street, the building today is called the Truman House, Senator Harry Truman was finishing a letter to his 20-year-old daughter, Margaret. He was about to drive alone to St. Louis and then to his home in Independence in his dove-gray Chrysler coupe, one of the last civilian autos produced before the Pearl Harbor attack and the conversion to tanks and warplanes. The president would not be alone. His Secret Service driver would pick up Lucy Mercer at her sister's house on Q Street. They would travel north through Maryland to Shangri-La, later Camp David, where they planned to spend the rest of the day and early evening at FDR's rustic retreat on a trout stream in the Catoctin Mountains. Franklin and Lucy, as those with even a casual acquaintance with the president's life know, had carried on a love affair which was discovered in 1918 by Franklin's wife, Eleanor. To avoid divorce and disinheritance, FDR had promised Eleanor and his mother, Sarah, to never see Lucy again. Yet, more than two decades later, Franklin was still in love with Lucy, and she with him. As the senator and the president took to the road, among their many thoughts were the Democratic National Convention that was scheduled to convene in 10 days, and FDR's health. In the letter to his daughter that he had just mailed, Truman wrote that dozens of people were plotting to make me VP against my will, and that he hoped he could dodge it at the convention. With a veiled reference to the president's precarious health, an open secret in Washington, he wrote that 1600 Pennsylvania is a nice address, but I'd rather not move in through the back door, or any other door, at age 60. Based on these comments, it is clear that Truman assumed, like most everyone else, that Roosevelt, after serving as president for almost 12 years, was going to stand for a fourth term, though it had not yet been officially announced. The staging and content of the public announcement that he would run once again had to have flickered through the president's heavily forested interior as he rode with Lucy that Sunday through the Maryland countryside. The previous Friday, in a meeting with Missourian Bob Hannigan, the new chair of the Democratic National Committee and one of Truman's closest associates, FDR had decided that he would announce his candidacy at a press and radio conference 2 days after returning from the trip to Shangri-La, a little more than a week before the convention. During the long Sunday he spent with Lucy on the road and at the presidential retreat, Franklin had to have also thought about, and perhaps even discussed with Lucy, whether he was strong enough, health-wise, to take on another term. According to a jaw-dropping memo that was suppressed until 2007, FDR had been informed by his personal physician just a day earlier that due to heart failure, he would be unable to complete a full 4-year term and that he had a very serious responsibility concerning who is the vice president. Thus, having decided on Friday to make public that he would run again, and been told by his doctor on Saturday that he would die in office if he did, the president on Sunday must have been weighing his odds of living against his desire to remain wartime commander-in-chief. Whether he gave any thought that day as to who would be his vice president will never be known. Though there is no record of what Franklin and Lucy actually discussed during the time they were together at Shangri-La, it is reasonable to surmise, as some historians have, that it was Lucy who validated Roosevelt's rash decision to launch his final campaign, even though she too feared that he might not survive a fourth term. A few minutes after 11 a.m. on Tuesday, July 11th, before a crowd of some 200 reporters in the White House, President Roosevelt began reading aloud a letter from him to Bob Hannigan. The letter was his somewhat presumptuous official announcement to the Democratic National Committee that, if nominated, he would reluctantly, but as a good soldier, accept and serve in the office if I am so ordered by the Commander-in-Chief of us all, the sovereign people of the United States. While speaking, his hands shook so much that he could not light his cigarette. There was no hint of who his running mate might be. In St. Louis, at roughly the same time, Harry Truman, like so many ordinary Americans during wartime rationing, was worried about the condition of his automobile tires. He needed to get home to Independence to pick up summer suits to wear at the convention, but all four tires were in terrible condition after the 840-mile drive on old two-lane U.S. 40 from Washington. However, as Harry wrote in a letter to his wife, Bess, he eventually located a tire man who, with some maneuvering, skirted the rationing restrictions to get him one new tire and four Goodyear puncture-proof tubes that had recently been exempted from the ration regulations. The senator, who by that time had befriended the tire man, invited him to have lunch with him and several of his St. Louis political cronies at the Coronado, an Art Deco hotel built in the 1920s that is in operation today. In his letter to Bess, Truman wrote, "You'd have thought I was making the tire man a knight of the garter, it pleased him so much." This was vintage Harry Truman, a man of the people. The lives of the world-famous president who was told he would not survive but ran anyway, and the obscure senator who claimed he did not want to run as his vice president, would soon intersect. This is a riveting slice of history in and of itself. However, it is the final months of Franklin Roosevelt's presidency, the unsteady transition of power to Harry Truman, and the liberation of tens of millions of people who survived the carnage of World War II that form the core of this book. It is a story of death and rebirth. After 82 days as Roosevelt's VP, Truman began his accidental presidency utterly unprepared. FDR made no effort to bring him up to speed on current foreign relations and domestic issues, nor did Truman insist on being informed by FDR or his staff. As vice president, Truman did not try to recruit experienced advisors or initiate a relationship with an outside foreign policy expert. As to Roosevelt's plans for the future, all Truman inherited was the unrealistic hope that he could achieve lasting peace by perpetuating his predecessor's apparent policy of cooperation and accommodation with the Soviet Union. If FDR actually had a vision for the post-war recovery of Europe and Japan, a stable China, and the conversion of the U.S. to a peacetime economy, he kept such thoughts to himself. Truman was left in the dark. It would take almost 4 years, but he managed, with the aid of George Marshall, Dean Acheson, George Kennan, and Arthur Vandenberg, to fashion a more muscular and confrontational policy that contained the Soviets without escalation to a hot war, revived Western Europe, supported General Douglas MacArthur's surprisingly liberal reforms in Japan, and midwifed the State of Israel, a home for Holocaust survivors. Framed by the presidential elections of 1944 and 1948, this study captures the illusions of a dying president and the mistakes and triumphs of his successor, an arc of world history that separated those who
Sample complete. Ready to continue?